So TechEd is Microsoft's sort of premier education event. Chance for us to come out, talk to you guys, meet you, share the newest exciting things that are going on inside of Microsoft. And there's a lot of work that goes on prior to us hopping in airplanes and flying to wherever the event is, and you guys coming and going through registration and ending up sitting in this room. Most of the speakers that you've seen have spent, oh, weeks, if not more, building their slide decks, rehearsing, going through content reviews, things like that with different teams to make sure that we have the best quality presentation. Each of these breakout sessions is typically 1 hour and 15 minutes. So if any of you were in my lunch session yesterday, whenever I was talking about Microsoft and Office 365 and Azure, you may have, I don't know if you could have detected, the sheer terror that swept through my body whenever I started talking and the little clock said 45 minutes. Because for the last 3 weeks, maybe longer, I had been working completely on the assumption that 1:30 to 2:15 in the afternoon was 1 hour and 15 minutes. Fortunately, I know that this session is 1 hour and 15 minutes. So unlike yesterday where it was like click, 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 let's just get through this speed talking, we'll have a little bit more time today. And that's good because this is probably one of the coolest features that is coming out, especially in the identity space for Windows Server 2012, and that's Dynamic Access Control. In fact, even with the extra time, if I do this right, there may even be a little bit of time left at the end for questions and Q&A. So save them for the end, but we'll definitely have time to chat afterwards as well. For any of you who missed my session yesterday or who have no idea who I am, my name's Brian Poole, and I am an architect on the Identity and Access Management team inside of Microsoft's IT department. So unlike the folks from the product groups or sales or marketing or consulting or anything like that, I'm probably closer to one of you. For my day job, I work with our operations and engineering team to run a Fortune, whatever it is, 10, Fortune 50, whatever it is, company, providing the identity and access services so that Microsoft employees can build Windows and Office and SQL and everything else. And so this presentation on Dynamic Access Control is going to be slightly different than anything that you may have seen up to this point. Up till now, if you sat through Matthias's overview or deep dive or anything like that, it was all about how Dynamic Access Control worked. What are the nuts and bolts? And that's important because you need to know how it works to know how to use it. But this is really more about what it's like to try to deploy it. Because about, I don't know, 6, 8 months ago, Matthias and one of his coworkers reached out to Microsoft's identity management team and said, "Hey, we've got this new feature. We know that you guys are going to be dog fooding. We want you to deploy it internally." We said, "Great, bring it." And so really what I'm doing is sharing stories about our experience, the good, the bad, the things that we've learned as an IT department trying to deploy Dynamic Access Control. Now, I'll still talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts, just because some of the things are interesting and they apply, but most of this is more about IT as opposed to the product itself of Dynamic Access Control. So with any luck, you'll get a good feel for, we'll still do the high level of how it works, but you'll get a good idea of what you should take away back to your environment as to how you should think about deploying DAC as you look at your Server 2012 deployment. So why do we even want to use DAC? Well, one, at least inside of Microsoft, because we were told to. That's usually why we do things. But even in your environment, you probably already are being told that you need to deploy DAC. You just don't know it. The terminology is being used of things like, we need better access control over our files. We need to do better data protection. We need better auditability, right? And those are the things that you're going to find, or those are the things, those are the challenges that we're trying to address with dynamic access control. We have a boatload of file servers all over our corporate network. Many of them managed, some of them not. All of them containing various classes of data, all of it mission critical, all of it important. Just tons of data all over the place, completely distributed. Causes a nightmare for us when the auditors come in and say, well, what about this? Who has access to that? Tell me what the controls are for this, right? It also doesn't help at all when I wake up in the morning and I reach over and I grab my phone, because this is the first thing that every Microsoft employee does when they wake up in the morning, is they reach over, they grab their phone, and they check email, because something was bound to happen in the middle of the night. And when the email is something to the effect of, major security incident, how did the Seattle Times find out or receive documents about Xbox 720, which happened recently? That's not good, right? All of a sudden, you know that you're going to get out of bed and go into work, and there's just going to be this whole fire going on of who had access to what, when, why, where, from how. And so a lot of these things are things that we're trying to manage. Now, there are multiple components to DAC, Dynamic Access Control. DAC couples tightly with auto transitioning slides. It couples tightly with the file classification infrastructure. And if you sat through Matthias's talk, you know that there's a whole big partner ecosystem out there around data classification, data protection, encryption, working with RMS, things like that. But I don't really care about that. Now, somebody in IT does, because somebody in our IT department, in our case, it's guys named Chris and Mark, that's actually their names, by the way, happen to manage most of our big file servers. But I'm an identity guy. So I'll leave the classification stuff to them. That's their problem. What I need to do is I need to understand how this is going to work from the clients to the AD infrastructure to the policies, and how we need to manage claims, and how we're going to deal with the user data challenges. So if you're not familiar with dynamic access control, this is sort of the standard DAC slide, right? You have user claims, potentially you have device claims. Those come together, which can be evaluated as part of a policy, which can be expressed on a file server, so that you can say something like, only users in the finance department who are authorized to have access to high business data can have access to that file. And if they don't, if the user doesn't have those properties, or they're not on a device that meets those criteria, they don't get access. And if they do, then they do get access. It's kind of neat stuff. So if that's how DAC works, then understanding how MSIT has deployed it inside of their environment, and really, what's more important than understanding what I've done in my job is how you're going to take this back to your job, right? So what I like to do is just to sort of do a little bit of a level set, okay? And the level set is, this is what my environment looks like. Now, my environment is multi-forest, multi-domain. We've got most of these domains have many child, or most of these forests have many child domains in them. We've got a broad ecosystem of partners and customers that we share data with. We've got RMS and PKI. We are very heavy into cloud adoption, both Windows Azure and Office 365. We do have a DMZ extranet network. Large ecosystem. Okay, and so whenever a product group comes to us and says, hey, we want you to deploy our feature, we say, great, it needs to work there. Okay? And if it can't work in this environment, then it's not going to work for you guys. Because we have made, evolved, somehow crumbled, pieced together over time, probably one of the more convoluted and complex enterprise identity ecosystems that anyone's ever imagined. So this is the environment that I'm talking about. Another important thing happens when a feature PM like Matthias or Sam D comes to MSIT and says, I want you to deploy my feature. Okay? There's one absolutely inviolable truth about feature PMs at Microsoft, and that is that their job is writing on their feature. And so it's the most important thing to them. And if you listen to any feature PM from any product inside of Microsoft, they will tell you that their feature is the one that's going to change the world. What you should do is you should pivot your entire business around their thing, whatever it is. And as IT pros, we all just nod our head and shake and go, you don't understand. I had my budget slashed by 10% again this year. Okay, that project, it's still not going to be funded. My domain controllers are still running on end-of-life hardware. Okay? No, I'm not going to re-architect my entire security infrastructure around your product or your feature. However, I do want to know about it. And I am interested in it because I do have real business challenges, and I do want to see how I can integrate them into my existing. And so these were really where we got our first sort of principles for deployment, which were, you know, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. When it came to dynamic access control, we just look at this as just another way to secure data. Okay? If we can make this more efficient, more dynamic, a little bit better, a little bit easier on our users, if we can reduce the number of $50 help desk calls, great. That's what we're looking for. Okay? Another thing that is useful to know about Microsoft and our internal environment is that we're very, some would say agile, some would say chaotic. We don't generally try to be overly restrictive. In our environment, we allow a lot of delegation. We allow users to have a lot of freedom. Anyone has the ability to join unlimited numbers of machines to our domain, for example. They just, you know, bring them in. Our sort of general mentality is that we want to get out of the way of our businesses. We provide the infrastructure, we provide the services, and then we step back and let the product groups go and build stuff and make money so that they can give a little bit to us. 10% more than last year, or 10% less than last year. Okay? But this applied itself to dynamic access control, because as we started to look at how we could build these models, there were two really main schools of thought. Okay? The first school of thought for dynamic access control was departmental based. Okay? So you build your DAC policies for HR and for legal and for finance and for, you know, in our case it'd be Windows or SQL or whoever. Right? And you can build those policies to the unique business requirements of those businesses, and then you apply the policies only to the servers that those businesses specify. Okay? Realize that apply the policy, it's almost more like publish the policy. Okay? So you make the policy available only for the servers that those businesses specify. The other way to think about this was, you just come up with a set of data classification-based policies. High impact, low impact, medium impact, PII data, similar, pick your acronym. And you link those at the top of the domain. And you publish them out. And then the different data owners are responsible for saying, you know what, this is HBI data, I'll apply the HBI policy. This is MBI data, I'll apply the MBI policy. When we thought about it like this, and we looked at the way that we manage our GPOs, And the way we manage our GPOs is we put everything up at the top of the domain and let it cascade down. We said, okay, that's the way for us. Again, it was part of the make services available so that the businesses can consume them. Of course, this had an interesting side effect for this, which is that if we have an HBI policy, which we do now, and we publish it out, because we're not targeting servers, we don't know where the policy is being used at. Right? Kind of a standard AD problem. This is very analogous to the problem with security groups. You can create a security group in AD, but you actually have no idea where it's at, so you never know if you can delete it, right? Even if it doesn't have any users in it, are you really sure you can delete it? Maybe we'll just let it sit for 6 months. So the issue with that, and the thing that we actually still haven't quite figured out how we're going to address, including the ringing phone in the background, tell them I'll call them back, is what happens when someone wants to make a change to that policy? Let's say it's the HBI policy. If security comes in and says, you know what, we want to turn this knob a little bit, or we want to change the parameters of this policy some, it becomes this broad notification exercise. So those are two different things that you can think about when you're looking at building your dynamic access control policies. Do you do them as generic, or do you do them as departmental, specialized, and targeted? If they're targeted, then you know exactly where they're used, but you're going to have more to manage, and you're going to have better relationships with your businesses and be able to evolve those and include security with those in those conversations. So these were some of the first problems that we had. Or it's not even problems, it's just interesting deployment challenges. So when we started this, the first thing that we do whenever we have a new feature come out is we look and we say, where can we use this at? And we came up with four core scenarios that on the surface looked like they would be good candidates for dynamic access control. We called them the first one, legal corporate affairs. Of course, after the first 10 minutes of sitting down with our legal corporate affairs people, we realized that they had absolutely no interest in dynamic access control. They were interested in the file classification infrastructure and RMS protection. Oh, okay. The next scenario was really interesting because there are these large file servers that Microsoft has that our support teams use. So you can imagine that you call Microsoft to open up a support case, right? And one of the things that may happen is the support analyst says, can you, here's a secure FTP or here's a script or something. Can you upload some log files or some trace data or take a repro and run this tool and upload the data to Microsoft so that our support analysts can dig into it for you? Okay? There's an issue with that because, well, let's see, we're in Europe, the home of privacy regulations, right? All kinds of privacy regulations, especially coming out of the EU. So some of the scenarios could generally be described as customer in the EU uploads data to Microsoft in the US. No problem. However, that data can only be accessed in the US. It can't be copied outside of the country because of privacy rules. Unfortunately, many of our support engineers are not located in the US. So the idea was, how do we build a DAC policy to say, if the user is located in the geographic United States, they have read access to this file to this data, and if they're not, then they don't. Okay, strike two. Turns out you can't do that either. And there's a reason why I'm talking about the things that we can't do, right? Because dynamic access control is really powerful, and we're going to talk about all the neat things that you can do with it, but it's a tool, just like anything else. You're going to look at it and say, hey, I could do all of this great stuff, and then you start to dig in, and, you know, some of it you can, some of it you can't. We went and talked to our payroll folks. So Microsoft, worldwide company, distributed payroll admins all over the place, big file servers, massive hierarchical file structures. Europe, Belgium, Brussels, Brussels sales office, Brussels support office, something else, right? You know, you can imagine these. And the rules around access to the payroll data were sufficiently complex and convoluted. There were things like, you know, the office manager can get to the data for his office, the regional person could get to the regional information, the country person could get to the country information. And we went, dynamic access control. We could do that. This is actually an excellent scenario for DAC, because you can start to do things like user.country equals resource.country. And you can get a match. And that's a simple policy that can apply across the entire hierarchy. So global payroll was one of the first scenarios that we actually succeeded in deploying DAC to. The last scenario was sort of interesting. We have these set of replicated file servers. We push bits all over the world. And it's called Whack Whack Products. And Whack Whack Products is exactly what you might think it is. It's the place where you can go to install unlocked anything that we've ever made. Perfect. If I want SQL on my laptop, I go Whack Whack Products to the SQL share, I click the installer, and poof, I've got SQL on my laptop. No sweat. If I want Microsoft Bob, I have to go dig a little bit, but I think he's in there somewhere still. The problem with that is that we also have a lot of vendors who come into our come and work for us. And we have about 95,000-98,000 full-time employees and about 180,000 humans who work for us day to day and have accounts with us. So outside of the full-time employees are contractors and vendors. And you have to know that if you're a contractor, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to walk in, you're going to take your laptop, you're going to plug it into the network, you're going to attach your hard drive, and you're going to go, products, copy. Right? Because you know what? I would. And so this was simply saying, if user is full-time employee, they get access to products. If they're not, they don't get access. Okay. The next thing, so these were the scenarios, and those are the scenarios to kind of keep in mind as we're as I'm walking through these, because I'll keep kind of referring back to them a little bit. But the point of that evaluation, the point of sharing with you the times that we tried and failed, was, again, DAC. It's a tool. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, just like every other tool. Okay? But we also knew that while those four scenarios may have been relevant to us, we wanted to figure out what was the process going to be like for when someone new came along. Say the HR department did come along and wanted to have a specific HR policy only for some servers, right? We weren't going to go and build those by default, but if they want to come in and help with some of the management and we can delegate to them, then we would do that. And so we started to think, what was the new request process going to be? And so this is the actual flowchart for our new request process for if someone comes in and says, I own a file server, I need a new DAC policy. Okay? The first large green diamond on there says, vetted by the DAC team. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's more or less what the rest of this presentation is going to be about, actually. So the DAC team will look, and we start to ask questions, and we start to think about, is this a good fit for dynamic access control based on what we know, based on our experience, based on what we know about our data, about our users, about the way that DAC works? Because realize, no business comes in and says, I want a dynamic access control policy. Usually what they do is you receive an email that says, I'm tired of having data leaked. IT, I need you to solve my security problem, right? And you're like, well, where do you store it? It's on a file server. You're like, oh, hey, maybe this is a DAC thing. So you got to keep that in mind. The way that we approach this is, and I'm not going to walk through the whole thing, but the slides are available. Essentially, what you can imagine is that the way we built the process was around test, validate, and then deploy. We very heavily leverage the what-if capability and the staging policies that are built into DAC, so that we can do things like deploy the policy out to the server, and then the business owner can go and make sure that it actually is doing what they thought it might be doing. Because, you know, most of the time, businesses get surprised. You ask them for requirements, they make something up, and then it's not what they thought they wanted. But back to this vetted by the DAC team. What do you think the first thing that happens is when we're vetting a new request? Probably something like, what claims are going to be needed, right? What data is going to be used here? Because we know that we're going to have to make an access decision. And so the question becomes, if we have a bunch of claims already configured that are being used by other policies, can we reuse those? Are those sufficient? If not, do we need a new claim? And if so, what makes a good claim? So what does make a good claim? Well, to start with, just because a claim may be available to ADFS, which is the other thing that uses claims, doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to work for DAC. Because DAC requires that your claims be available in AD. So if it's not an attribute on the user account, it's not a claim. Pretty easy. So you need to also evaluate think about how the attributes are populated. So about an hour ago, we had sort of an open dialogue lunch session with the AD product group, and one of the questions was something along the lines of, what about the risks to what about building DAC policies around attributes that users could go in and change? Because there are some sets of attributes that a user could actually go in and modify themselves. And you wouldn't want to build a DAC policy around that, right? Right. You wouldn't want to build a DAC policy around that. You want to make sure that the attributes that you're using are populated from managed sources. Now, what's a managed source? It means that it's some place that you know where the data is coming from. Now, if a user can go in and change the attribute, that may be okay. Why? Because you do not want to have a DAC policy that says access to this super sensitive stuff is to users with title equals program manager, and then have the user go in and just change their title to program manager and get access to it, right? On the other hand, you may actually want to have a policy that says access to the secret squirrel stuff is by user if user.title equals program manager. So long as your HR system is enforcing that the only people who have the title of program manager are program managers, right? Then that would make sense. It's the same policy. It's all around the data management. Of course, if the HR system is managing the title that says program manager, so you think that would be good. I can create, I can ACL this super secret data to user.title equals program manager. Okay? Did anybody tell HR that? And what did they say? Because if you don't have a relationship with all the way back to the source of the data, HR may initiate a project later on in life, maybe a year down the road, where they say, you know what? We're going to classify things. We're going to change people's titles, and we're going to make them Program Manager 1, Program Manager 2, and Program Manager 3, depending on seniority. And when they go through and do that, entirely in their system, in the HR team makes a change in the HR system to HR data, this business just lost complete access to all of its critical data and came to a complete standstill because IT had the policy that said, your title is not program manager anymore. You lose, right? That would be really bad. So you actually have to go, it's both understanding where it's managed from and engaging the business to make sure that they know that data that once was previously considered just what I'd like to describe as profile data, right, is now being used for security. And those are big differences. That's a big change, right? Because if it's just profile data, then who cares? It changes in the GAL, given enough time, everything updates, and you know what? When the user logs in, the string changed from program manager to program manager 3. Congratulations, you're senior. Of course, if he comes in and is access denied on the file server, then there's going to be all kinds of craziness, and your help desk is going to explode $50 a pop every time it rings. Okay. So we know that we've got this big data management problem. Or it's not a problem, it's just a consideration. This also made me think in the other session, and I'm going to diverge off the slide a little bit, because back in about Windows 2000 time frame, there was a lot of conversations around how do you decide what kind of data do you put in AD? Had to be things like globally relevant, does it change frequently, you know? Those are the same things that you consider for a new claim. Is it globally relevant? Is an attribute only relevant to one file server? Or is it something like title that can be relevant to everything else? So is it application specific or is it user specific? User specific's good, app specific's not. But there's also some other guidance, and it's one of the principles that I've had for a long time as a identity/AD architect, and that is, Active Directory is not authoritative for any mission critical data. It's a publishing source. Now let's see if that makes sense. What is AD good at? AD is good at being discovered by Windows clients. They have this whole DC locator thing. They find it all over the place. It's good at becoming consistent. Replication is pretty darn rock solid. It's good at being highly available because of those two. Okay? It scales great for reading data. What is it not good at? It's not good at ensuring that every time someone enters a phone number that they put the area code or the country code with it. Because AD doesn't enforce business rules, right? You could try to do some fancy UI tricks in the MMC, but at the end of the day, AD doesn't actually care. Okay? So our principle that we use is AD is for publishing. We want to get the data out and make it available. But AD is not authoritative. If there's anything that's important, AKA anything that would be used as a DAC claim, it needs to be authored somewhere else. Okay? It should be replicated into AD. We use FIM for that. And then that source applies the business policy. So that's where you get things like who is allowed to change the user's title. Right? It's the authoritative sources problem. It's the HR systems problem. That's not what AD is for. AD is for publishing and making the claims. Okay, enough on that. So the last thing to think about is, what if I just go through and make every AD attribute on the user a claim? That's a good idea, right? Because then everything would just be available and I don't have to worry about this later. Well, claims bloat is token bloat, so you don't want to do that. Plus, if you look inside AD and you look at any given user account, most of the stuff there you wouldn't want to use anyways. Think of how many attributes are populated on any given user account for Exchange. And then add link, right? Okay, there's over half of them right there, okay? I may have 100 attributes populated on my user account, of which like 5 are useful for DAC, okay? My country, my region, my title, my manager, something like that. Okay. Then you go through and you have to start thinking about what happens when you create a new claim type. And this was great because this was part of our first deployment in that product scenario We said we need a claim type so that we can evaluate the policy so that only full-time employees have access to the installers for our products. We need a user claim, and we screwed it up first time out of the gate. It was awesome. What we did was our 15-year veteran of the team, not me, the other one, sat down and said, MMC, or ADAC technically, new claim, source attribute, employee ID. Now, which attribute in AD do you source the employee ID from? I'll give you a hint. It's probably the one called employee ID, right? However, inside of Microsoft, we have to make everything confusing and more complex than it really needs to be, and we don't actually use the employee ID attribute. We take the user's employee type. Just go back and find and replace those. Employee type, as in, is the user a vendor or a full-time employee? Okay. But we don't use the employee type attribute for the employee type because, one, that would make sense, and we can't do that. But, two, turns out that the employee type attribute is only readable by the domain controller, domain admins, and the user themselves, which makes it pretty useless. Okay? And so rather than going and trying to change the property sets and all that stuff, we just looked and said, hey, Exchange created these 15 extension attributes. Let's take number 2 and stick employee type in there. That way, any application that comes along can do an AD query and find out what the user's employee type is. But the first time that we went to create this claim, the engineer went in, opened the MMC, chose employee type, said, yep, the claim's in place. Everybody rebooted because, well, that's what you do. And then we all went to access the file server, and we had a 100% hit rate. Denied, 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 denied. Because none of us had the claim. And then we probably spent 45 minutes or an hour troubleshooting, trying to figure out why we weren't doing it. And then we went, oh, well, that was dumb. And then we went back, deleted the old claim, created a new claim, associated it with the right attribute, and then the next thing happens. You have to name it. Do you realize that the first time that we named this claim, the claim was called is FTE, as in is full-time employee. Again, see, I like to think that we're bright sometimes, and then other times we have shining moments that I get to share at Tech Ed. Okay? You don't name the claim is FTE because that's not what the data is trying to represent. The data is representing the employee type. So name the thing employee type, please. Great. So we name it employee type. We say that it's a property of the user. We give it some smarmy little description there. And then you can provide suggested values. Now, these are optional, but you could think of this as an enumeration of all of the potential values useful by the file server admins when they go because they're building the policies, or when you're building your DAC policies or you're building your CAPs. And whenever you're building your central access policies, you want to be able to do things like have friendly names and stuff. So if you have a value that has a finite number of potential options, then you put in the suggested values. If you don't, you don't. Okay? So what we did was we did this. He goes in, and in our case, we use integers because we pull them straight out of SAP, and type 50 is FTE, type 92 is a vendor, type 90 is a business partner, an intern, or something like that. So what was the problem here? Because he got the screen, it looked just like this, he clicked OK and said, try it again, and we all rebooted, and we all got access, except for one. Talk about that in a sec. But what was the problem here? Because this was how we stayed for about 4 days. He looked and said, the only value that I need on this claim is full-time employee because that happens to be the only one that I'm using right now. So it's the only one that I'm going to put in. Went back and said, no, smack upside the head. If you're going to put in the suggested values, put them all in, because otherwise you're going to have to come back to this claim later and try to figure them out, and nobody's going to understand why it is that whenever they go to create a CAP policy, They hit the suggested values, and it only says FTE there, but they need to build a policy for vendors, right? So when you're here, finish, right? So try not to do things halfway. But that was sort of our experience of building the first new claim. The next thing that we had to do was we had to decide how we were going to do access denied remediation. Why? Because the only thing better than being a domain admin is making other people locked out, right? You know, I mean, that's the beauty of that power. So if you want to be able to lock people out, you got to give them some way. And as much as I love throwing up the default access denied message that says, sorry, sucks to be you, access denied remediation helps save us the help desk phone call. So there's a couple of different options. And you can configure these things on the server, on the share, or even down to the folder. Note that the configurable message per folder is only became available in the 2012 RC. Yes, you can all thank me for that later. So yeah, that became a really big issue on some of the internal, some of the large shared file servers. But the options are you can provide a message to the user, or you can let them send email to someone, not you. Of course, inside of Microsoft, we have all these self-serve portals and all these self-serve locations or tools that we've created. Again, it's part of that provide the tools to the business so that we can get out of the way and go back to drinking our lattes thing. So we wanted to just say, let's tie this in with our existing service. Turns out that the powers that be let you stick HTML tags inside those error messages. So something to the effect of, I go to a file server. I click on the folder that says, give me access to the Windows builds. The error message comes up and says, sorry, if you're trying to get access to the Windows builds, you need to go to the access control portal, click this link. It takes me to the page on there that lets me request access from the Windows builds business owner, right? So that I can request access from them, and if the powers that be decide that, yes, I should have access, great, I can. They'll add me to that group or whatever the case may be. So this was our approach, we're heavily leveraging the HTML tag capability that's inside here so that we can throw these rich messages up and provide those links. I can't wait for the day. It just occurred to me that there's also a potential for ASCII art in this. Someone's got to do that. However, access denied is fun, but there's one truism that's forever and ever of identity management. Identity management is exception management, right? Because you know what? If I could drop everyone into an attribute and a role, I would probably have been outsourced a long, long time ago, okay? Identity management is exception management, and here's the DAC program. We have Matthias, and we have Nir, and we have Graham and from the product groups, and we've got the best and brightest of IT from file servers and from the business units and identity management. And we're thinking, how in the world are we going to do exception management? Because for payroll, for that payroll scenario, it's very nice that the person in the Brussels sales office has access to the Brussels payroll, but when they go on vacation, the person from Paris is going to cover for them. And we need to be able to grant them access. And then we want to be able to take that away. And so we started drawing. And we had like 32 feet of whiteboard. And we started at one end, and we said, let's create exception GUIDs. And then that would give us the ability, every time we create a dynamic access policy, we'll put user.exception equals resource.exception. And if we do exception GUIDs, then we need to extend the schema. That's okay. We're okay with extending the schema if necessary. So we could extend the schema to add these exception GUIDs as an attribute on the users. And then we need a portal. And We started to design this portal, and we said, if you're a file server admin and you want a dynamic access control policy, then what you do is you go to the portal, you register in the portal, you get a GUID, you tag all your data with this GUID, we'll start stamping the user, we'll build this exception process, we'll do the claim type mapping. Oh my goodness, we reinvented security groups. It was awesome. We had this thing nailed to everything except for the backlinks. We hadn't thought about the backlinks yet when all of a sudden we went, wow, self-service portal, like FIM. Wow, multi-valued attribute on the user object, like member of. Okay, turns out that the goal of dynamic access control is not to prevent you from using security groups. That's not its purpose. Security groups have a place. Security groups are great for what they're for what they do. Okay? However, dynamic access control lets you take care of the 80% case, right? It lets you take care of the common case, and then you still manage your exceptions the same way that we've always managed exceptions, by someone walking down to Jean in reception and having her add you to the security group, because she's the only one who knows which one it is. Then we started thinking about auditing. And I got to tell you, inside of Microsoft, our largest domain is called Redmond. And in the Redmond domain, which is part of the Corp Forest, we've got about 35,000 employees or so. And on a typical Monday morning at 10 a.m., which is the peak log-on time during the week for us, the audit event logs, which we have grown to something excessively large, wrap in about 3 minutes. That's just how fast they go, because we're just spinning so much traffic and we have so much auditing turned on. So we know that we already have this auditing challenge. And our auditing the way that we address this is we use a central auditing collector based on the audit collection service that comes with SCOM or SCCM or one of the SCs. I don't know. Okay. And so we're currently looking, trying to figure out how we can manage or take our dynamic access control onboarding and tie the auditing aspects of it into that service. Now, this is sort of unique for us, and we don't actually do this yet. And the reason that we don't actually do this yet is because with the rate of events that are currently coming into that system, every Monday morning at about 10 a.m., in the back corner of the data center, you hear, "Help me, I'm dying." And it sounds something like that. And so we're trying to figure out if we can pile more and more and more events onto this thing with all these file servers. But one of the things that we do use very heavily from the auditing perspective is the staging policies. Staging policies are effectively saying, apply this policy to these files, but don't actually enforce it. Just log events. And the events are incredibly rich. They will tell you that this user tried to access this file, they were access denied based on this property of this, and they had this claim and this policy, and that's why they were denied. And so if they were supposed to be denied, great, denied, great. And if they were supposed to have been allowed, you need to go fix something. Probably put them into a security group and give them an exception. And then there was our deployment approach. Our deployment approach, again, thinking back to that complex multi-forest environment, we wanted to make sure that, we always have this sort of nagging concern in the back of our mind, which you probably do too, something along the lines of, if I turn this on, is everything going to crash? Right? And we said, yeah, we don't want to do that. So we knew that when we enabled claims, that the user token was going to grow a little bit. And that was okay. We do have some issues with token size right now. But because of our group management capabilities with FIM, we pretend to have a reasonably tight grasp on it. However, one of the things that we need to do was we looked and said, this deployment is no longer just about the DCs, right? Because what happens when you take a new OS and you install it on the first domain controller? Every one of the new client OSs goes, hey, there's a domain controller in my version. Kill it, right? And they all jump on it, okay? And so we didn't want to have that happen. Fortunately, with dynamic access control, the Windows 8 clients won't actually start to pile on to Windows 8 servers until you enable the Kerberos setting on the Kerb TGT, until you turn on claims, until you notify, you set the default domain controller policy so that claims will be enabled. At that point, all of the Windows 8 clients on your network will start sniffing around and hunting for the nearest Windows 8 domain controller to jump on. Okay? So that was useful because our client team got Windows 8 deployed out long before the AD team ever came along and were working on our servers. So since we knew that we had some reasonable mass of Windows 8 clients out there, what we did was we started to think about how many DCs do we need to be able to support the load when once we turn on user claims. Now for us, the number was something like 3 or 4. It was a handful, right? We also run ridiculously large domain controllers. There's something like 24 procs with 100 gigs of RAM or something like that. So we had the capacity. But it's one of the things that you need to think about, is because more often than not, what I find is that the team that's doing the upgrades of the servers are not the ones that are also doing the upgrades of the clients. Those usually are two teams that are separate parts of the IT organization that don't talk to each other. And if one gets out there first, then the other one needs to compensate. Okay? And if you're like us and you're the AD team and you show up a little bit later to the party, it becomes important. You should also figure out not only do you need to think of the complexity of your end-to-end data management for your claims and how they're populated on the users, but also how that translates across multiple forests. Fortunately, we have 7 production forests, 17 production domains, and 1 AD team. So we keep everything really consistent. However, if you're in an environment where you've got multiple forests and multiple teams that are populating multiple data and multiple sets of data in different ways, then you need to negotiate how you're going to deal with the cross-forest claims transformation rules so that when user.title comes across and is going to map to user.title in your forest, you understand what those data flows are going to be like. Okay? If you're familiar with ADFS, the cross-forest claims transform rules are very, very analogous to ADFS claims transform rules. Now, I said that we needed to have some critical mass of servers deployed, which was true, but one of the bits of feedback that Microsoft has always had from customers is we don't like features that require us to be in domain mode. And we really don't like features that require us to be in forest mode, right? There's something about that one-way switch that people just tend to get a little sketchy about. So it is a nice part of dynamic access control that technically, by all rights, domain mode's not required. However, you may want to consider waiting until you have, like I said, some representative majority of your domain controllers upgraded. It may be 3 or 4 if all of your users are located in one spot and are going to be able to and hit a common data center. If your users are spread across WANs all around the world, you may need to wait until you get Server 2012 domain controllers located in all of those branches. Otherwise, their traffic's going to start coming back to where you've done the upgrades. But technically, you do not need to wait for domain mode. You do just need to be planful about your deployment. And your deployment's entirely going to depend on what your environment looks like and where your users are located and what clients they're running. If you're not running Win8 clients, it doesn't really matter nearly as much. Okay? Because we don't require domain mode, and it is just a GPO, It's not a one-way switch. You can turn it off. That's really comforting, because if I turn on the Kerberos setting and I start issuing user claims, and some random application that has some crazy MIT curb standard dependency starts to tip over, right, I can turn it off. And the DCs will go back to their non-claims issuance state. However, note that that doesn't get rid of the user's TGTs, and their TGTs have claims in them. So your recovery time is actually the 10-hour TGT issuance time or one reboot of the client. Okay? So it is reversible, but it's not as though it's not light switch reversible. It's more like light switch on, long slow dimmer off. When I'm talking about the cross-forest implementation, one of the challenges is that nobody upgrades all of their forests all at the same time. Even inside of IT, we don't upgrade all of our forests, all of the DCs, all at the same time. Too many boxes, too many environments, too few people. So what happens then if you have a user who is in a forest that has a 2012 domain controller and can get claims, and maybe it's a Win8 client, but and they are accessing a file server that is a server 2012 file server that's using dynamic access control, but their authentication request happens to go through a Windows 2008 R2 domain controller. Fortunately, we're leveraging SID filtering so that we can ensure the consistency and the integrity of data, because it comes back to those claims transform rules. Remember that in a cross-forest situation, one of the things you want to do is you want to make sure that your claims rules are firing and executing so that by the time the user data gets down to the file server, it has the integrity for the domain that it's in as opposed to the one that the user's in, right? Because it's going to evaluate based on that, on the data that comes from its domain controller. So the way that this works is there's a new SID. There's a new special SID, and the SID is 000. And the way that what happens is when the user authenticates, the user gets their TGT, and their TGT has their claims, their groups, and it has this SID. We refer to it as the Sentinel SID because it's a flag. It's all it's intended to do. And because their TGT has this flag, whenever the user goes to access the file server in the other domain, they need to go through the Kerberos dance. And part of the Kerberos dance is to get a TGS to the domain. So that TGS will also, because it came from the server 2012 DC, will contain the claims and the groups and the Sentinel SID still. However, the server 2008 R2 DC doesn't know what to, it sort of ignores the claims, but it sees that Sentinel SID. And it says, hey, I'm going to apply my SID filtering rules when I give you the TGS to my file server, because I don't let you have SIDs that didn't come from your domain. So it strips that out. Because it stripped that Sentinel SID out, the file server, which is server 2012, knows that those claims may not have been transformed for its domain. So what it will do is it is actually going to do a logon request back on behalf of the user and request a new token so that it can request a token with claims. And it will flow that in it, and the 2012 server will ensure that that flows through appropriate up-level domain controllers as necessary. So I've gone over a whole lot. I said that I'd end a little bit early, and I am. But that's okay if you have any questions. I've gone over a whole lot. Lots of things to consider as you're looking at DAC from the IT perspective. Your deployment approach. How are you staging this? Have your file server admins already run out, downloaded server 2012 RC, and started to upgrade their file servers? Because they can. There's nothing that's going to stop them, right? And so they may already be looking at this. You could already have Server 2012 in your domain. What about your client team? Because you want to make sure that as the resources, the DCs, and the clients come online, you manage those behaviors and you manage the integration. Identity data governance. This is a big topic, and dynamic access control is going to make it even bigger. Okay, where's the data coming from? How is it sourced? How's it managed? Was it ever intended to be used for security? Probably not. Most attributes weren't intended to be used for security. What are the management requirements to start using it for security? Okay, should we consider updating the schema to add a new attribute? Absolutely. One of the things that I, as a Microsoft employee, has always been disappointed in was all of the FUD, fear, uncertainty, doubt, that Microsoft spread a long time ago around schema extensions. You know what? If the data is globally relevant, if it's not application specific, if it doesn't change a lot, if it provides business value, extend the schema. Populate the data. Populate it from a managed source using automation. Make it available as a claim. Get the business value from it. I haven't checked recently. Actually, I haven't checked in about a year. But last year, sometime last summer, I just for kicks, I took CSVDE and I dumped the schema of one of our production forest, of our corp forest, and I took all of the objects in the schema and I sorted them by when created date, and it turns out that Microsoft has averaged one schema extension every 6 months since April of 1999. Because we don't care, it's fine. Just keep going. Just knock them out. You have a schema change process. Use it. Be diligent about it, right? If you don't have a schema change process, go to Microsoft.com, WAC Showcase, and download ours. And use that as a start. MSIT has published our schema change process, so you can see how we do it. So hopefully this was valuable for you. Hopefully this was a slightly different take on the dynamic access control conversations. Maybe it raised some thoughts. If you have questions, let me know. I'll also be down in the TLC at the booth, at the AD DAC booth down there. I hope you have all enjoyed Tech Ed and keep getting a lot of value from these sessions, because I know that we, as presenters, we put a ton of work into them. But most of all, thanks for sitting and listening to me. Appreciate it. Thank you.